Hello there. I hope you're doing well in these crazy times in which we're living. Thanks for tuning into the first episode of Enlighten, the science podcast. During each of these podcast sessions, we'll be inviting scientists to answer some of life's big questions, as well as talking about their lives, their passions, and their work. My name is Ollie Higgins, and I'll be this episode's host. We hope to be releasing episodes on an approximately monthly schedule, so if you enjoy this, please do check back in a month's time for another program. It's February, it's cold, it's dark, and it's rainy. This time of year, I always find myself thinking about getting away from it all and going somewhere sunny. Spain, Thailand, why not Mars? For our first episode, we were lucky enough to catch up with Professor Charles Coquell. Charles is an astrobiologist at the University of Edinburgh and the director of the UK Centre for Astrobiology. He completed his undergraduate degree in molecular biology at the University of Bristol and a PhD in biophysics from the University of Oxford, before embarking on an accomplished research career that has involved projects with NASA, Stanford University, and the British Antarctic Survey. If you're interested in this topic, I highly recommend that you check out his YouTube videos, which are informative, thought-provoking, and at times, completely mental. You can't hear it in the recording because I was on mute. I spent a lot of time laughing during the interview. It was really fun. Towards the end of the interview, we discussed some voluntary opportunities to help develop the first Martian cookbook, among other things. And if you're interested in getting involved with that, please do get in touch with Charles. So, without further ado, here's our interview with Professor Charles Coquell, where we try to answer one of life's big questions. Are we alone in the universe?
Hi, Charles. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine, thank you. And thank you for inviting me on this podcast.
You're very welcome. We're very happy to have you. So I'll start right with it. We wanted to ask you, how did you get to where you are today? How did you get interested in this topic?
Yeah, I've always been interested in space exploration from a very, very young age. In fact, I remember when I was about seven reading a book about the Apollo missions to the moon. And at the back of that book, there was two sides of the one page discussing bases on the surface of Mars in the 1980s. So I'm showing you my age now. And that really inspired me. And I'll start off this podcast with a very depressing statement that when I was about seven, I really thought that in my late 20s, I would be going to Mars. But these bases were described. People had great ambitions after the Apollo program to move on to Mars to establish a permanent human presence. Obviously, that never happened, but it inspired me. And I've always had this interest in space exploration, but I've also always had an interest in biology. I inherited a moth collection from my grandfather, who had this wonderful Victorian moth collection that I think was it was collected by a vicar in the 19th century. He got it from somewhere, I'm not sure where, and then I inherited it. And then when I was young, I had this interest in moth catching, which I did for many years as a hobby. So there was always this biology strand in my life and this space strand. And I always wanted to connect those two things. It was never easy when I was in my early part of my career to do that. But I was lucky enough that when I did my postdoctoral work, which was at NASA Ames in the mid-90s, that was when NASA founded the Astrobiology Institute, the NASA Astrobiology Institute, which brought biology and space together into astrobiology. And that's when astrobiology really became a formal field. And I was able to indulge this interest in life sciences and space exploration in the same subject. So in some sense, I've been quite lucky to be able to pursue space biology in the framework of this subject we call astrobiology. But my interest in space sciences and biology goes back to when I was very, very young. I've always pursued that in one way or another as I've gone through my life.
What are the key signs of extraterrestrial life?
Yes, so of course now we have many new missions flying to other planets like Mars and planned missions to the icy moons. These are moons orbiting Saturn and Jupiter that have large bodies of liquid water beneath their surfaces. We don't know if these places have life, but what's thrilling is that over the last few decades, we found more and more environments where there either is or was liquid water, which is one of the key requirements for life. and many of the other requirements for life as well, sources of carbon atoms and phosphorus atoms and nitrogen atoms and these other types of elements that you need or we think you need to construct life. So we don't know whether we're going to find life in the next few decades, whether we're going to answer this question. But what is exciting is we found locations that are very promising to address this hypothesis of life beyond the Earth. And we can send missions to these places in our own solar system. And probably one of the most thrilling frontiers in astronomy is, of course, the detection of exoplanets orbiting distant stars. And we will build telescopes in the next few decades. Astronomers will build them that allow them to look for gases in the atmospheres of these planets that could be indicative of life. For example, high concentrations of oxygen that can be only rarely produced by non-biological processes, but could be used as a way to look for life on the surfaces of other planets that are producing oxygen gas. And of course, exoplanets, unlike planets in our own solar system, are statistically limitless in the sense there are, you know, thousands, hundreds of thousands of these planets that we could look for life on. It's only limited by our observational capacities with telescopes. And that's why I describe it as a thrilling frontier, because in our own solar system, we just have a handful of places we can look for life. Mars, the icy moons, people have talked about subsurface ocean on Pluto. That's a slightly more outlandish place to look for life. But nevertheless, even with outlandish assumptions, you've only got a handful of places in our own solar system where you could look for life. But of course, exoplanets opens up a vast number of possible places where we could look for indirect evidence of life in the form of gases. So again, you know, at the moment, we have no idea about whether we will find life. We might discover that we are in a lifeless universe with very little evidence of life elsewhere. That in itself would be a thrilling and fascinating discovery. But what is amazing is that we now have the missions and the technology to finally answer a question that people have been pondering on, sometimes a little bit less scientifically and more philosophically, but they've been pondering on it for centuries. So we will get some sort of answer to the question, is there evidence of life beyond the Earth in the next few decades? And I think that will be a very exciting advance in biological sciences.
It certainly sounds exciting, but you assume that the signs of life that you mentioned, they assume that life would be similar to what we find on Earth. You mentioned in your book, The Equations of Life, How Physics Shapes Evolution, that universal physical laws argue against radically different life forms elsewhere. So are common ideas about possible completely different life, like non-carbon life forms or giant amoebas or whatever, are they realistic?
Yeah, it's interesting, this question of could we build life from a completely different architecture? The first thing we have to remember is, of course, there is just one periodic table. We can look at distant galaxies and we can look at the spectra of distant galaxies, and we know they're made of the same elements. So we know that the periodic table is universal. And that may sound like a trivial observation, but actually it's important from a biological point of view, because it means that the building blocks of life, if it exists elsewhere, are the same building blocks as the elements used to build life on Earth. Now, of course, you should always be careful in science not to introduce confirmation bias and to make assumptions about the elements from which life is made based on what you know. But what's interesting is we do know something about the chemistry of the elements in the periodic table. We've been studying them for a long time. And we know which elements will form chains under different conditions and complex molecules from which you might be able to build complex replicating life forms. And that, I think, does give us a basis to speculate about life elsewhere, because it's rooted in chemistry and physics, not in wild speculation. For example, you could ask yourself, let's take a wild speculation and think about life that's not based on carbon as one of the key molecules from which, key elements rather, from which molecules are constructed. And you can do that in a logical way. You can go to the periodic table and you can say which element is most similar to carbon. And you move down in the periodic table and there you find silicon just below carbon. And then you find, if you look at the chemistry of silicon, it does similar things to carbon. It forms long chain-like structures. It has electrons that can bolt onto other heteroatoms, other types of atoms, and form complex structures. But what you find is that when silicon binds to oxygen, it forms these highly regular structures that we all know as minerals and rocks. In other words, silicon does do things like carbon. It forms complex chemical compounds, but they turn out to be rocks. And so, you know, when people say, well, you know, we don't know what incredible alien things might be happening on other planets for silicon, they forget that we've had 4.5 billion years of weird silicon chemistry occurring on our own planet and occurring in front of our own eyes, and it's rocks and minerals. So these sorts of thoughts allow us to see how elements behave in the presence of other elements and the sorts of structures they form. And those structures are universal. When you look at other planets, you see they're made of silicates. They may be also made of carbides and other types of less familiar compounds on the Earth, but they're still behaving in ways that we would predict based on the periodic table. So I'm rather conservative about my view of carbon life elsewhere in the universe and how it might be constructed. And I think it would be constructed in similar ways to life on Earth. I think that complex molecules would use carbon as the backbone atom to create complexity. It may well be that life elsewhere would have different molecules. I wouldn't go as far as saying that DNA will be exactly the same on another planet. I think we could imagine other types of molecules that would store information, just as we see RNA and DNA and interesting polypeptides, proteins on the Earth. So we can imagine biochemical diversity. I don't think one would say that the biochemistry of life elsewhere would be exactly the same, but I wouldn't mind putting an unscientific bet on the fact that the chemistry of life, the fundamental chemistry, and the sorts of uses of elements that we see in the periodic table on the Earth would be very similar elsewhere in the universe. Now, before I completely close the door on alien chemistries, there are intriguing possibilities like liquid ammonia, for example, as a solvent for carrying out chemistry rather than liquid water. Liquid ammonia does all sorts of interesting things. It dissolves, it forms solvated electron solutions. Electrons move around in life in the process of gathering energy. Electron transfer chains are the core of energy transduction in life and the acquisition of energy, free energy from the universe. And liquid ammonia forms solvated electron solutions. And it's also less viscous than liquid water under some conditions. So it might actually be better for moving molecules around faster inside a liquid ammonia cell than a liquid water cell. So I think that the door is still open to alternative chemistries, particularly when we think about solvents, liquids that might be used to do chemistry in. But I think the fundamental molecular structure of life would follow what we currently understand about the periodic table. But I should also say, as a scientist, I wouldn't be so narrow-minded as to say that the fundamental chemistry of life will be exactly like life on Earth. There's always new things to learn and things that we don't understand about elements in the periodic table that might throw up wild surprises in chemical complexity in the coming years. But that would be my view, that I think that life elsewhere would probably be a lot less different than science fiction writers in the past may have thought.
Okay. I will admit I'm somewhat disappointed about the idea that there's not giant rock monsters out there somewhere.
Well, there was an interesting, there's been interesting speculations about larvobes and magmobes, which are these life forms that live in lava and, in magma chambers. But of course, we don't observe those things on the Earth. That's not to say they don't exist elsewhere. But in fact, if you step back from, again, it's difficult to argue these points without going in circles, because you could argue that we don't see them on the Earth just because they haven't evolved here. But in fact, the rest of the universe is full of magmobes. But in fact, if you try and step back from that prejudice and you think about the physics and chemistry of magma and lava, you might predict that those would actually not be very good places for ordered chemical compounds, given the amount of energy that would break those things down. So I think what we see on the Earth is what we would predict. Another interesting point just to make briefly is when we look at other planets, we don't see things that would make us believe that our imaginations are limited. For example, when you look on the surface of Venus at about 460 degrees Celsius, you don't see giant silicon-based elephants walking around the surface of that planet. You actually see what you would predict based on our inverted commas narrow view of life on Earth. You would predict that 460 degrees would make complex carbon compounds fall apart, silica would be in the form of rocks, and we don't know of any other chemistry that will operate at 460 degrees that will produce complex replicating evolving life forms. And that's exactly what we see on Venus. Same thing on Mars. There we would predict that chemical conditions in the subsurface might be habitable to life, and indeed that remains an open question. We would predict also that there would not be giant polar bears walking around at minus 150 degrees at the Martian polar ice caps, chomping on bits of polar ice and covering themselves up in the cold polar night, because the conditions are too extreme for multicellular life to exist there. There's not a sufficient source of liquid water, and it's very difficult to melt the Martian polar ice at minus 150. Your physical predictions would be there would not be polar bears at the Martian polar ice caps, and there are not polar bears as far as we know. So for everywhere where we look in the solar system, other planets, what we see is actually what we would predict based on our so-called narrow-minded view of life on Earth. And I think that that's telling you something about the robustness of our ability to make predictions. Again, without being, I'm not being dogmatic here, I think we should keep our minds open, but I think to go back to my earlier point, the periodic table does actually allow you to make some quite objective assessments about the possibilities for life elsewhere that are not necessarily narrow-minded and Earth-centric.
Yeah, that's really interesting from a point of trying to, you know, narrow down what is life and does it look like anything that's here? Because obviously, you know, you talk about these sort of, magmas?
Yes, yes.
You know, that doesn't look like anything that would, you know, live on Earth, obviously. But is there a kind of, you know, philosophical basis for how we talk about life? Is there a kind of, you know, is there one definition?
Yeah, so this is a sort of separate question, I guess, which is what are we talking about in the first place when we use this word life? My own view is that life is just a human definition, and I think it circumscribes certain types of organic matter that grow, reproduce, and evolve. That's the material we happen to be interested in. And I think that's okay. It's okay to say we have a particular interest in looking at material that behaves in this way, that reproduces and evolves, and we're going to call this life, and we're going to go and look for this elsewhere in the universe. You asked the question, is there some single definition of life? That's something that a lot of people argue about. My own personal view is no. I think it is just something that people dreamt up. And I think it's a continuum from say methane, CH4, up to a human being. This is all organic chemistry. And as you increase the complexity, more interesting things happen. You start to build chains of organic molecules that fold up and form interesting templates or polypeptides. You put lots of polypeptides and DNA together, you start to get things that have a code in them and reproduce and evolve. And this, you end up with this extraordinary matter, and let's not be in any doubt about it, that things that reproduce and evolve are an extraordinary manifestation of organic chemistry. But I think that's all they are. I think we're, you know, human beings are just organic gunk that does something interesting. And we stick this word life on it, and that's okay to circumscribe part of organic chemistry that we happen to have a particular interest in, that also happens to include us. I think you should be very suspicious of any definition that defines something as being interesting that happens to include human beings. I think that makes me immediately suspicious. But it's okay. It's okay to say that we are part of a class of objects that are interesting from an organic chemistry point of view. We're going to call this stuff life, and we're going to go out into the rest of the universe and ask the question, are there other instances of material that behaves in a similar way? But if our interest is in matter that replicates and evolves or does other things, we should keep an open mind as to what this life is. If we went to another planet, let's just say speculatively, I'm not convinced by this, but let's just say we went to another planet and we did look in a magma chamber and there were these extraordinary, you know, complex behaviors of liquid lava that looked highly suspicious and looked very ordered, and for some reason looked like they were replicating and they were not just simple chemical processes, but there was something, there was some information content in there that made us think that looks very much like life, then sure, I think it would be completely okay to expand the definition of life to include this new type of material. So open-mindedness is always something that scientists should have. If we see complexity in the universe beyond the Earth that makes us suspicious that we're looking at something that's not just simple, chemical reactions not under the control of a code, then we should take an interest in that matter. But I think the whole question is, what is the definition of life, is an utterly boring discussion, in my view, that philosophers have wasted centuries trying to come up with single definitions of life. And it's boring just because it's not rooted in science. It's just a human, it's like arguing about the definition of a chair. I bring this up in my astrobiology classes to my undergraduates. I ask them, what is a chair? And they'll say something like, it's something you sit on. And then I'll show them a picture of a stool on a slide. I'll say, what's that? And they'll say, well, that's a chair. Then I'll show them a picture of a coffee table that looks like a stool. And I'll say, what's that? They'll say, it's a table. And I'll say, well, what's the difference between a table and a stool? And then we'll have all sorts of arguments. And of course, we'll come to the conclusion that we only call a stool, a chair, because we have a tradition of sitting on it. And we call a coffee table, which you can happily sit on, a table, because generally we use it for putting objects on, not for sitting on. So it's a human definition. It's not rooted in science. It's what philosophers would call a non-natural kind. It's not rooted in some fundamental physical attribute. It's just how people like to label things. I think life is the same thing. You can have centuries of discussion about what is life, but you'll never get anywhere because people have different views on where to draw that line in organic chemistry. Some people would say that a virus is not alive because it can't replicate on its own, but a rabbit can't replicate on its own, right? It needs another rabbit to replicate. So is a pair of rabbits life, but one rabbit on its own is not life because it cannot replicate on its own, and so on. You know, you can have these arguments indefinitely. I don't think it's interesting, but I think we can come up with a working definition. Working definition is life is really interesting organic matter that replicates and evolves in response to its environment and can lead to complex states of this organic material, like human beings that can think and build radio telescopes. That's interesting stuff, and we would like to find that elsewhere in the universe.
Right. Yeah, I think I was reading one of James Lovelock's books a while ago. I think it was The Gaia Hypothesis, one of the first books he wrote. Mm-hmm. He was writing about when he was working at NASA and someone asked him, you know, like, what would you look for if you were looking for life? And he said, well, just anything that's a negative change in entropy, sort of a system which becomes more complex over time. I was wondering, you know, sort of when you define something like that, you know, a starting point for looking for life in the universe, you know, how do you do that? Kind of what methods do you look at for detecting life in the solar system?
Yeah, I mean, I think the negative entropy response is interesting. Of course, a lot of abiotic reactions can result in complexity. You can form, you know, complex minerals and chains. They may not necessarily interest you from respect to life, but I think any system in the universe where you get order out of disorder, you know, a collapse of a chain of molecule into something more orders should interest human beings because it might reflect an environment where you could get greater complexification towards things that are replicating and evolving in ordered ways that contain a code. So I think from a scientific point of view, anything you see in the universe that represents complexity from simple monomers coming together should catch your imagination. You should look in that environment more detail. How do you look for life? Well, this is something that's occupying the minds of a lot of people, this idea of agnostic signatures of life. How do you look for this replicating, evolving material with the minimum number of assumptions? And I think that people would have different answers to that. And I think my answer, which is a fairly banal sort of mundane answer, is to look for chains. You know, any place where you've got long chains of atoms stuck together, I think should interest you. For example, in meteorites, you can find amino acids. There have been reports of dipeptides where you've got two amino acids that have dehydrated and formed a link. But you don't see proteins, long proteins in meteorites, you know, 100 amino acids strung together in a chain. You find nuclear bases in meteorites as well, but you won't find a strand of RNA or DNA, or at least as far as we know, there are no strands of RNA and DNA in meteorites. So I think a general conception of life detection, in my view, would be very simply looking for chains of things, molecules or atoms strung together in chains that would make you suspicious that locally there had been some chemical environment that was sufficiently stable to allow complexity or potentially a life form that has synthesized these molecules as part of a living thing. So that's where I would start, looking for chains. And there are people thinking about that. You know, what length of chain does actually constitute biology? What level of complexity can you get through non-biological processes? And there are many chemists thinking about these questions and trying to develop models and quantitative ways of assessing chemical complexity in different environments. It's a really interesting question. It's actually not my area of expertise, but I think it's an interesting area in chemistry as to where complexity makes you suspicious of something that might be going on that would interest you as a person seeking life.
And so from a sensing point of view, you know, how do we actually do this? I mean, you know, do we, if we're going to find some of these amino acids in a meteorite orbiting the Earth, do we have to go up and drill, you know, a piece of that rock and bring it back down? Or, you know, what are the kind of sensing apparatus that we use for sensing life kind of close to home in our solar system?
Yes, I mean, that's a good question. I'm not an expert in mass spectrometry, GCMS, gas chromatograph, mass spectrometry, these sorts of methods that are used for organic compounds. But I think from an approach point of view, your best bet is to get samples and bring them back to the Earth. I mean, this is the motivation, of course, behind Mars sample return and collecting samples from comets and asteroids, for the very simple reason that there's a limited complexity of instrument you can send into space. Whereas if you bring a sample back, you can apply multi-million dollar capabilities and large instruments in laboratories, nanosims, highly complex mass spectrometers that take up a whole room that are very difficult to send directly to comets or to the surface of Mars. So although the complexity of sensing and detection technologies improves all the time, that technology you can put on a rover or a spacecraft is always likely to be less sophisticated and less sensitive than instruments you have on the Earth, for the very simple reason that you're not space limited on the Earth. So I don't think that whatever the complexity of equipment we can send elsewhere, I might be wrong, but I don't think there will ever be a time where you can do better than simply bringing the sample back to the Earth. Of course, the other reason for bringing it back to the Earth is more of a scientific methodology perspective on this, which is simply that it's good to have more than one lab looking at a sample. And of course, you could have four or five independent instruments on a spacecraft. So you've got N equals five labs effectively on a spacecraft, but then you've still only got that one sample that you've collected from one place. And of course, on the Earth, your multiple laboratories are being run by different people, different teams. So you've got true independence of data analysis. So again, from a scientific point of view, I think it will always be better to bring samples back to the Earth, distribute them among multiple laboratories, and get that statistical robustness in both the analysis and in the interpretation of data. Yeah. I should say you could send humans to Mars. I mean, you know, if there's an effort to explore Mars with humans, which is something I'm very much in favor of, then you could send a large laboratory to Mars with quite sophisticated analytical methods. In fact, longer term, if you really want to explore globally the surface of Mars for the presence of life and truly get an understanding of the distribution of life or not on the surface of that planet, you would do well to send humans with a laboratory and have them go out on expeditions and collect samples. That's going to be more cost effective than launching multiple Mars sample return missions over many decades. So I think longer term, if we truly want to understand the conditions in our solar system for life, as well as many other scientific questions, human explorers is a good way to go.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we'd like to talk about that more in depth in a second. We just have one other kind of philosophical question on this sort of, you know, the search for life in the universe. And it's, you know, you may not have a great prepared answer for this, but we were wondering how you would look for life further away from our solar system. So for example, in sort of distant galaxies and things like that.
Yeah, this is a really interesting question. Actually, I was having a conversation about this with someone about a month ago, exactly this, which is the observational limits of biology. So of course, cosmology has in principle, it's got observational limits in terms of what you can physically look at, which is the observable universe. But cosmologists can use theory to understand, you know, the first nanoseconds of the universe, which is what they do. They think about what happened at the Big Bang and immediately afterwards. So theoretically and practically, you could say cosmology is not that limited in terms of its observational and theoretical capacities. Biologists are a lot more limited because there's a sort of sphere, if you like, around the Earth where we're observationally limited, and that is in our ability to detect life. So we can look for gases in the atmosphere of exoplanets. How big a telescope do you need to look for gases like oxygen in exoplanets in distant galaxies? For example, what would I need to detect the biosignature in the Andromeda galaxy? That was actually something, that was what I was talking about a month ago to a fellow astronomer. Where are the observational limits for biology? So a little bit like the cosmologists, we can think about the origin of life theoretically, and we could conjecture the origin of life in distant parts of the universe. When it comes to actually observing life directly, at the moment we're limited to exoplanets that we can observe within maybe a few thousands, tens of thousands of light years when we eventually build a telescope that can look at the atmospheres of exoplanets. When you start to look at atmospheres of exoplanets, hundreds of thousands of light years away, and then eventually extragalactic astrobiology, which I think would be an awesome subject, it's just very difficult to do it. How would you look for a biosignature in the atmosphere of an exoplanet in a galaxy, you know, a billion light years away, or in a quasar, if you wanted to look for evidence of life 2 billion years after the formation of the universe? How do you look for a signature of life in a quasar? Is it even physically possible? That's the interesting question. Or is it outside the capacities of any technological solution? So I think this is a really interesting question. What are the observational limits of biology? And I have no answer to it, other than that they're clearly more limited than the observational limits to cosmology and astronomy, which might make biology an intrinsically more limited subject than astronomy, which I also think is an interesting philosophical question on what are the limits of biology.
So there could be bacteria on exoplanets or something similar, and we couldn't even detect them at the moment. There would be no way for us to tell.
Yeah, I mean, we may not be able to detect them simply because they're not producing a signature. Mm. But I think the point of principle is, even if they were filling their atmosphere with a gas that was distinctly biological, what would be the ultimate limits of detectability of those gases?
So we might never be able to tell, or not for a long time, whether life exists on exoplanets.
I think we will within our near galactic neighborhood. Mm-hmm. Telescopes like HABEX and LIGOIRE, which will potentially give us the first steps towards detecting signatures of life in the atmospheres of exoplanets within hundreds or thousands of light years from us. So we'll be able to answer the question of does life exist on other planets, exoplanets, within our near galactic neighborhood. The technological question becomes, how far can you push that beyond tens of thousands to hundreds of thousands of light years? And ultimately, you know, is there any prospect of a field of, as I said, extragalactic astrobiology? Is that even possible?
It might necessitate building a base elsewhere and starting from there, if that's possible.
Yeah, it's a question of building a large enough telescope to be able to resolve, spectral dips of gases associated with life like oxygen in a planet so far away. What size telescope do you need? And if you do the calculations, you end up with outlandish telescopes with, you know, diameters the size of the Earth or greater. So unless the technology changes, or the methods of detection of life changing, the technological challenge is huge.
Yeah, I think maybe that's actually quite a convenient segue into asking you about some of your work with bringing life into space, really. I'm bringing, you mentioned it earlier, your sort of, run for political office.
Yes.
That was kind of, well, actually, it was quite intrinsically linked to the idea of exploring the cosmos more.
Yeah. Well, as I say, my interest in Mars exploration goes back a long way. And I was doing my PhD in Oxford, and I was actually in a pub with some friends, and I was lamenting the lack of British involvement in Mars exploration, human Mars exploration in particular. And it was a month before the general election. And my friend said, well, if you feel so strongly about this, why don't you stand in the general election? And by closing time, all my friends, there were about five of us there, had all agreed to be members of the shadow cabinet of this new political party that we dreamt up. And I called it the Forward to Mars Party. And one of my friends became the shadow environment secretary. Someone agreed to be my election agent. We had a shadow education secretary. And literally the next day, we drove up to Huntingdon constituency in Cambridgeshire, which is where John Major was standing. He was prime minister at the time. And at that time, to create a political party, you basically had to get 10 signatures from people on the street saying they would vote for you in the election. They're not bound to that. They just have to sign a piece of paper saying in principle they would vote for your party. So that's what we did. And we registered the Forward to Mars Party. And my sister's husband came up and put a loudspeaker on the top of my Mini, which is the car I had at the time. And so that was our election battle bus. And we created our slogan was, it's time for a change of planet. And then we had a bunch of policy plans, which was, you know, to expand human space exploration and British involvement in space exploration. And we went up to Huntingdon every week, and every Saturday I stood on there was a wonderful Victorian letterbox. I don't know whether it's still there in the High Street. And I would stand on that and give lectures about Mars exploration and rally support for the party and give lectures in hospital radios. It was an amazing experience, actually, because we met, you know, every type of person. When you're on the street campaigning, you meet every type of human being possible and hear about people's personal stories. You know, I met someone who had been a Japanese prisoner of war working on the Burma Railway. I met other people who had, were setting up some company to sell titanium, and, you know, just the diversity of people's various ways of making a living. And this went on for a month and a half, and then we stood in the election, I went to the town hall discussion where I debated with John Major. And then on election night, we got the votes in. We got 91 votes. We came second last. We beat the Natural Law Party, who got, I think, 46 or something, I forget now. But we were beaten by Lord Buckethead, who got 110. And of course, by Screaming Lord Such, the monster raving loony party. But that's almost a political establishment in this country now. But I don't know who those 91 people were. I had no relatives in Huntingdon.
I was going to say, it's quite a lot of votes, actually. Impressive.
It's a sort of scary number, actually. Because when you think about it, you know, we formed a political party in a month. And then I went out and gave all these lectures on the street, and 91 people who only get an opportunity once every 4 years to vote for a party that would run the whole country actually went and put a cross next to my name. I think that's sort of terrifying, actually. Yeah. Thankful for the votes, but it's terrifying.
No, it's amazing. Has Lord Buckethead kind of reached out as an intergalactic envoy and said, you know, you're interested in space, I'm interested, I'm from another planet?
No, I had a conversation with him on election night. This was in 92, you know, before the vote came out. And he had a policy to expand the European Union to cover the known universe, and was castigating me for my small-minded view of space politics, for just sticking to Mars. But he comes from the planet Gremloid, and he spent the whole evening handing out videos. Of course, then, 1992, it was VCR. So he had this stack of VCRs, and he would just go around handing them out to everyone before the vote was announced. So he was a bit of a crazy figure, but, you know, it was fun. I learned a lot. I met a lot of people. I also learned about the political process and developed a sort of, you know, a deep-seated interest in actually the process of democracy and how democracies work, partly because 91 people voted for me. It really did make me think, you know, how the hell did that happen? And how did 91 people who I didn't know vote for a political party on the basis of a month and a half of election? It made me think about why people vote for things. And in fact, it's interesting with respect to the Trump phenomenon, of the way in which, with a bit of populism and rallying, you can actually get people to vote for you relatively easily. That surprised me that we got 91 votes. And so it taught me a lot of things about democracy and free governance and how it works. But, you know, I'm not going to deny it. It was also fun. I mean, I was a PhD student then, and I couldn't do it now. I don't think I'd go and stand for the Forward to Mars party as, you know, professor at Edinburgh. Or maybe it would be okay, but I think people would sort of squint at me. Whereas when you're sort of 24, I think I was 24, 25, five then, I forget now. But anyway, at that age, you get away with those sorts of things, and people just, you know, just go fine, whatever. So it's a good time to do it. It was interesting, and I think, and this is my only claim of sanity in this thing, is that it was the first political party to represent another planet and representatives of another planet. So I hope that when we get to Mars and people set up governments there, they'll realize that the first Martian political party actually occurred in 1992 in the UK in the dim and distant dark ages. So from that point of view, it was fun. It was a bit of history setting up a party to represent people on another planet. Anyway, that was my part of my mad misspent youth.
No, it's fantastic that you're going to, you know, one of the nearly democratically elected representatives for another planet. Is there a democratic process for how we kind of deal with other planets? Is there any idea for, you know, for example, I know there's kind of probably various flags of various countries on the moon at the moment. You know, there's, I guess, a few robots on Mars. But is there any thoughts for how we sort of deal with who owns those territories?
Yeah, there is the Outer Space Treaty, the UN Outer Space Treaty, which stipulates that, you know, these objects are the province of all mankind. They can't just be claimed by people. But actually, there are loopholes there because individuals can go to these planets and set up mine. The US Commercial Space Act allows, for example, people from the US to go to another planet and find resources, and the US will recognize the claim on those individual resources. So if you land on a planet and you set up a mine, I think you probably can, with the support of your home country, claim those resources. But you can't just go around claiming planets, at least under the UN rule. I think that there are clearly going to be problems ahead, because as private corporations move out into space and maybe even establish private space stations or private settlements on the moon or Mars, it's difficult to know whether these things are really going to happen. But if they do, then there will be more complex questions to be raised about how you claim ownership on other planets. What area of territory around a station can you legitimately claim as your own? And I don't think there's any easy answer to that. My own view, and it's just a personal view, is that space is a lethal environment. It's very, very difficult to survive out there. And I think every incentive should be given to encourage anyone to move out into space. I think putting restrictions on resource acquisition and resource claims is simply going to stifle the capacity of humanity to move out into space. And I personally think, however much people dislike the idea, if a rich corporation can find a resource in space that is exploitable for profitable purposes, and as a consequence of that, they actually plan a private space program that will permanently get humanity out into space and settling the solar system, I think they should be encouraged to do that, because I'm not convinced government will successfully do this in any reasonable length of time. So I am actually in favor of the private exploitation of resources in space. But I think once you get out there, you know, it's a good idea to try and make sure that these resources are equitably distributed on the Earth and they don't lead to vast inequalities in humanity. So I think you can introduce ways to do that without necessarily completely removing the incentive to explore space. It's the question of how you get the balance between encouraging private corporations to explore and exploit resources in space, whilst at the same time introducing into those sorts of regulations the capacity to distribute these resources to people on the Earth without removing that incentive altogether. I think that's a difficult thing to do. I think it's difficult to do in a way that will make everyone happy. I think people are always going to have problems in the way in which that's done. I think it's a fascinating question as to how you do that whilst maintaining any liberty in space. This is another subject I've been interested in for a while, which is, you know, space is an inherently lethal environment, and therefore people are going to be controlling the oxygen that you need to breathe. And unlike food and water, oxygen you require on a second-to-second timescale. And so there's a possibility of all-encompassing tyranny in space. This is not a new idea. Science fiction writers have pursued this idea for a while. If you've ever seen the What's the film on Mars? I've completely just been out of my head.
Total Recall.
Yeah. The original Total Recall has a scenario of people being tyrannized from the control of oxygen. So this isn't a new idea, but I think it's an important idea because there might be the potential for economic slavery from a corporation that has under its control a small group of people that cannot easily get away from an isolated extraterrestrial settlement. So buried within these questions of, can people claim resources in space? Who owns the moon? Who owns other places in space? Is this question of how do you also maximize liberty in space and not end up with a collection of tyrannical dictatorships spread across the solar system being run by tyrannical states or private corporations? It's a really interesting question.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's fascinating. It's something I'd actually never thought of. But I mean, you know, we have problems enough with kind of exploitation of some workers on Earth. I mean, if you then go to a place where you literally can't leave, you know, that does change things.
Yes, it does. Yeah. And it's not an easy thing to, I mean, you can introduce things like constitutions, and people have talked about introducing constitutions. But as Tocqueville, who is a political philosopher who, you know, traveled to the US in the 19th century and wrote a famous book called Democracy in America, he makes the point in there that Mexico, for example, has a very similar geographical location to the US, and they also wrote a constitution that was similar to the US, and yet the political outcome is very different from this sense of individual freedom that the US has. And one of the reasons for that, of course, is the culture and the expectations of the people who went to the US and formed these early settlements. They came often from religious groups seeking freedom, whether in England or Dutch colonists. So the mentality of these people was different. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that just having a constitution doesn't do. You can make a wonderful document that's got bills of rights and statements of how you build a society, but in fact, that constitution does not necessarily work unless there's a culture of democracy in the people who go to these environments. How do you inculcate that into people who go into space? It's not an easy thing to do because people take that with them and they take attitudes with them. So you might select people who go into space who you think carry with them a culture of liberty. And maybe that's a bunch of people that want religious freedom, or maybe it's a group of people that just want to get away from entrenched views on the Earth, but that's still no guarantee of freedom. So what you have to, I think, do is identify the aspects of free societies on the Earth that are outside constitutions that are part of the culture, and you need to try and inculcate those into governments on in interplanetary environments where that will maximize the chances of liberal ideas taking root and liberal governments successfully taking root. It's an interesting question.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. While we're on the subject of Mars, you obviously do a lot of this amazing work in prisons. So, you know, maybe would you be okay to kind of talk a little bit about the project and how long?
Yes. So the Life Beyond project is a project I started to improve science education in prisons, but also to get prisoners to design settlements for the moon and Mars and think beyond their confines to exploring space. And this idea actually came from a view I had a long time ago that prisons are a little bit like Mars stations, lunar stations. They have a confined population that can't get out very easily. There's a lot of interdependency in that population. And they have a knowledge of confinement, which is going to be the chief problem on the moon or Mars. So with that idea in mind, about 3-4 years ago, 2016, I Googled one lunch break teaching and learning Scottish prisons. And I came up with Jim King's name, who deals with education and learning in Scottish prisons. And I emailed him and said, I've got this idea about an education program for prisons. And I went and spoke to him about the idea of getting prisoners to use their knowledge of confinement to design stations for the moon or Mars. And he said, well, you know, why didn't you come and give some lectures in some Scottish prisons and we'll see how it goes. So I went and gave an hour and a half session in 4 Scottish prisons, Shotts, Lomas, Edinburgh and Glenochel. And what I did is I basically gave a 3-course of an hour lecture on astrobiology, just to set the scene, talk about you know, search for life elsewhere, human presence in space. And then for the final part of that session, I got the prisoners to break up into groups and talk about what it would be like to go to Mars and why would we ever go there in the first place? Is that a good idea? And the feedback from those sessions was excellent. And they were really enthusiastic for more of this. So I essentially designed and devised a course that runs in four segments that can be run in prisons. And that's what we've been doing for the last 3 years. And the course is essentially takes the prisoners through thinking about conditions on other planets. They then design Mars and lunar stations. And then in the end of that, we've published a book, and we've published two books, Life Beyond from Prison to Mars and Life Beyond from Prison to the Moon, where we ran a moon project. And it involves about 25, 30 prisoners. They do everything from science and engineering designs, if they have that sort of background, through to artistic work. So we've had some wonderful paintings of stations on the moon or Mars. We had a couple of prisoners in Glenochle who wrote a whole album of Martian blues music. They were interested in music. We ran a creative writing competition in Glenochle where prisoners had to write their first email home from Mars. One of the things that we've discovered about this project is that it goes way beyond science and engineering. I mean, I began this idea with the thought that those who had science background would design stations. And now it's spread out to art and writing and music, simply because, of course, we don't have any stations on the moon or Mars. So anyone's idea is a fair game. So it's a very open field, this. So why do this? Well, I think the thing that's motivating for me about this is that we're taking people who often have a very poor view of education and have had very bad experiences in education and getting them to make a contribution to, if you like, one of civilization's greatest ambitions, which is to explore space. And most prisoners would never even conceive of the idea that in the space of 4 weeks, they could go from no knowledge about space exploration to writing a book about humanity's most ambitious goal, which is to establish settlements on the moon or Mars. And this is, it's a much overused word these days, but it is transformative, genuinely transformative for these prisoners. And we've had personal testimonies from them about how it made them feel like a human being to have someone from a university come in and say, right, I want to hear what your ideas are on this ambition. I want you to write something and I want you to publish a book. That's a very astonishing idea to them, to write a book. We sent these books off to the European Astronaut Corps. One of my jobs, another thing I do, I won't talk about right now, is I train European astronauts in astrobiology as part of the ESA astronaut training program. So that's been very helpful because it's meant I've been able to take these books and send them to astronauts, and they've signed inside these books saying fantastic work. And we take these books and give them back to the prisoners, and they get this affirmation from astronauts, which is also astonishingly powerful for them. So in summary, this project is about trying to get people in an essentially not good situation, you know, being in a prison, to understand that they can make a contribution to society at the highest level, the highest creative level. And this has been one, hugely successful, but two, very fulfilling for those of us involved in this program. So I've had some of my PhD students go into the prisons with me and do this. And for all of us, it's just very fulfilling. It's a very enjoyable experience to go in and use your knowledge in a way that is productive, I think, and helpful for other people. We've now taken this material. The problem with Life Beyond right from the beginning is we had to go into the prisons and deliver it ourselves in person. And that's very limiting because we have a limited amount of time. So during the lockdown, I worked with a master's student in physics and astronomy, and we've produced a complete course that can be done by any prisoner in any cell. So it's a 3-month course. They work their way through it. It provides them with all the information they need, and they fill in boxes like writing letters home from Mars. And they send this material back to me here at Edinburgh. And we're going to write books based on material coming in from prisons in England and Wales. This is going to be promoted by the Prisoners Education Trust, but it's also going to be put online so a prisoner anywhere in the world can do this course and send it back. And we've also made short activities for prisoners they can do in one afternoon. And one initiative we're doing is one of those activities is to ask prisoners to to come up with recipes for food and to paint dishes of food or paint people sitting on Mars having a banquet. And we're going to put all that together and we're going to make a prisoner's lunar and Martian cookbook over the next 2 or 3 years from this material that comes in. So that's one of our next projects. And we're also going to take the rest of the material and write Life Beyond books based on the material that comes in from prison. So that's really exciting because now we've disconnected our need to go into prisons and we've created something that can be done in cell. Now, that's very important during the pandemic, but even after the pandemic, having materials that can be done by prisoners without the need for learning centers that not all prisons have will, I think, be very powerful. So I'm really excited about this next stage of the Life Beyond project. So that's Life Beyond, space exploration with prisoners. And I think it's, it's the work they do is fantastic. It's as good as anything you get out of a space agency, maybe not quite as technically advanced because they don't have libraries to work from. But in terms of creative output, it's pretty impressive what they do.
It's a very impressive project.
Yeah, that's absolutely fantastic. And you can actually buy the sort of outputs from the so you can buy these books on Amazon.
Yeah, you can buy the books on Amazon. We publish them with the British Interplanetary Society. They're sold at just above cost, about £6. There's about 50p profit that goes into education programs at the British Interplanetary Society. So they took on the task of actually taking the materials and making the books. That was what they did, which was very welcome just because it's a difficult thing to make all the formatting. And then as I say, they sell it at near cost. There's a very small overhead cost there that goes back into education programs in the British Interplanetary Society. So you can get those on Amazon, both of them. Yeah.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I mean, if obviously we're going to put this out, I mean, if anyone is kind of listening and would be interested in getting involved in this, would you be, interested in having them contact you?
Yes, I would. I mean, one thing you can do is you can join me in Scottish prisons delivering this if you're interested. If you really want to get some experience teaching in prisons, I'm open to that. But also if you can do anything, if you feel like you'd like to get involved with putting together materials that come in from prisons in the new iteration of this course, the in-cell iteration, we could do with some help there. If anyone is good at illustrating as well and wants to get involved in the Martian and Lunar Prisoners Cookbook, there will come a point, hopefully in a couple of years or in the next year or so, when we want to start putting that together. So I could do with some graphic design help in thinking about how you would do that as well, if anyone's got any good suggestions. But yeah, if anyone sees any angle on this where you might be interested in getting involved, do please feel free to drop me an email.
Such a cool project.
Really fun. It's been really good. Yeah. And as I say, fulfilling. It's a challenging cross-section of the population to teach. And I think, I obviously enjoy my teaching here at Edinburgh, but there's something about being in prisons where you really do feel you're making a difference because they have very few educational opportunities. So with a small amount of teaching, you can make a contribution, a quite significant contribution to a cross-section that, as I say, doesn't have those opportunities.
If I can just briefly interrupt with some exposition. The next few minutes of the interview is what we like to refer to as the tinfoil hat questions, where we get Charles's opinions on the subject of some conspiracy theories. There was a few minutes of the interview where I'm justifying why the questions are going to suddenly change gear, so I've just cut that out for time. So if it seems like an abrupt change, that's why.
At the moment, the human race is kind of constantly broadcasting out to the universe. Do you think this is a good idea with potentially hostile civilizations out there?
Yeah, this is an interesting question. Actually, it sounds like a sort of crazy question, but it's sort of a serious question. My own view is if they want to find us, they've already found us. Because if you think about it, we're building telescopes to look for oxygen in the atmospheres of other planets as an indication of life. And we've had an oxygen biosignature on the Earth, well, an intense one for about 700 million years, but actually oxygen in the atmosphere at lower concentrations going back 2.5 billion years. So if there are any aliens that really have the capability to be malevolent and travel around the galaxy destroying civilizations, they've no doubt detected the high concentrations of oxygen and probably maybe detected civilization on the surface of the planet. So I do think that sending out radio signals to try and attract aliens is probably not going to put us in any more of a dangerous situation than we're in already. If there's something bad out there, they can come for us already. They don't need us to be sending signals. Would they be malevolent? I sort of find that, I mean, again, there's this thing about, you know, you're making your assumptions based on the culture of human beings. But it's difficult to be objective, but if you stand back for it from this, imagine us, you know, we build a spacefaring civilization, we make the effort to go out into space, we travel to other planets, and we find another civilization. I mean, would we really just turn up and destroy that civilization? What would be the motive for doing that? Surely, when you've reached that level of technological capacity, you would be astonished to find another intelligence, and you would engage with it with extreme care, but you would find it another remarkable instance of life in the universe. Why would you just gratuitously destroy it? So I find it difficult to believe there would be any meaningful motivation for another civilization to come and destroy our own civilization, unless, of course, all civilizations have the same biochemistry, and planets with high concentrations of oxygen and a biosphere are very rare and therefore very prized. And if you want to go and colonize other planets, you've got to kick out the existing incumbents to take up ownership of that planet. But even in that situation, unless there was some devastating apocalypse on their home planet and they really needed a planet with 20% oxygen in, and the Earth was the nearest one, and they thought, that looks nice, we'll have that, thank you. You know, if they've got the technical capacity to do that, there's not much we can do about that right now. So sending out a few signals to try and communicate with them, I don't think will add much to our woes.
If they'll even be able to arrive at us before we blow ourselves up.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the other problem. They may find a vacated planet, but if they do find a vacated planet, it's probably also a radioactive wasteland. So, yeah.
Yeah. So obviously we know that aliens built the pyramids. But we're wondering, what is your opinion on whether aliens have ever visited us?
Yeah, well, I think there's a good chance there's life somewhere. I mean, this is coming back to a general question about life elsewhere in the universe. Of course, we don't know. It could be that the origin of life is an extremely rare event and there's nothing out there. Has life ever visited the Earth? I'll tell you a funny anecdote. When I was in my postdoc, there was this retired policeman who had got some sand from the pyramids. He'd gone to Egypt, he got some sands, he'd sent it off for some mineral analysis. Someone got some XRF done somewhere, and it came back with concentration. He had compared that to the composition of Martian soil and decided this was evidence that the pyramids had been built by Martians. Of course, Mars is made of silicate rocks. It's not surprising you find silica in sand you get from Egypt. But anyway, he had decided this composition. So he called up, and I was at NASA at the time. So, of course, people like this tend to call NASA. And it was a sort of standing joke that everyone, like I did, passed him on to someone else. So when he came to me, I said, well, you know, I'm not the expert on this, but you should speak to my colleague down the corridor, who is a fellow postdoc, because he knows a lot about extraterrestrial sands. And this is a very interesting discovery. You should speak to him. And I look back on that and I feel so bad about it. It was a very unprofessional behavior. But, you know, the poor guy was convinced every time he was handed on, there was a conspiracy, of course, because we were handing him on to other people because we knew stuff. And this was sort of part of the joke. It was very unfair and it's very cruel. But there are a lot of people who believe these things, and I don't really want to go into the psychology of that. I think it's like all conspiracy theories. People want to believe that there are wonderful things out there in the universe that are about to be revealed that will spice up their lives, and everyone is in a conspiracy to maintain us in this sort of mundane state of knowledge where aliens did not build the pyramids. How boring could that be? But no, I don't think they built the pyramids. And have there ever been visitations of aliens in the past? Well, of course, we have no evidence for that. The history of the Earth is a long one, 4.5 billion years. Who knows? Maybe some aliens did land on the Earth a billion years ago, looked around, took some samples and disappeared. And how would we ever know that happened? There's always the interesting speculation at the origin of life. Life on Earth may have started from an old wrapper that was left in an alien picnic. You know, they came to the Earth 4.5 billion years ago when it was cooled down sufficiently to be somewhere interesting. You might want to have a picnic. They land on the Earth, they eat their picnic, they throw the wrapper out of their alien whisper or whatever it is they ate for their picnic, and it's contaminated, and life starts on Earth. So even if the origin of life was extremely rare, maybe it happened in one place and it's been spread by alien picnics. Of course, all these things are fun. The problem is they're not really scientific hypotheses in the true sense that you can falsify them or test them in any way. So it's very difficult to make any progress, these ideas. You can't deny them. And this is the problem with these conspiracy theories, because people say, well, you know, you can't prove that that hasn't happened. Well, of course we can't prove it hasn't happened, but that doesn't make it any more of a reasonable hypothesis. So, sorry, that's a very long-winded way of saying, I don't know. but you know, hypotheses need to be constructed on testable data, hypotheses need to be testable and falsifiable in some way. And if that's not possible, then these ideas are fun, but then they're not really ideas that we can progress on.
Yeah, okay, I see.
Very boring response.
The idea that the aliens came here, they were having a picnic, and then they threw away one of the pyramids was part of a sandwich wrapper or something. that's great. We have one last question, and no longer as part of the kind of tinfoil hat question hour. But so we wanted to kind of close this by asking you, if someone was thinking about becoming an astrobiologist and you wanted to give them one piece of advice, what would that piece of advice be?
Yeah, I often get asked this. I get emails saying, how do I become an astrobiologist? And people get very obsessed by this word astrobiology. I'm a microbiologist. I did my degree in biochemistry and my PhD in molecular biophysics. And I think astrobiology is it's a good term because it brings biologists and astronomers and planetary scientists together. But actually, it's not a good subject necessarily that you'd want to be trained in, just because you need to come at any subject with a core understanding of something. So to come to your question, my advice would be get a good background in a robust subject that's got depth to it. So for example, if you're interested in exoplanets, maybe you become an astronomer. If you're interested in the origin of life, maybe you get a degree in chemistry and do a PhD in chemistry. If you're interested in life in extreme environments, maybe you go off and become a microbiologist. And then with that sort of degree background, you can then use that to connect to other subjects and contribute to questions in astrobiology, like the origin of life, you know, life elsewhere, how does life adapt to extreme environments on the Earth, looking for life on exoplanets, whatever else it is. But it's always good to have a core subject in which you're very robustly trained. And in fact, in some ways, that's why I wouldn't even be necessarily that in favor of an undergraduate degree in astrobiology, even if someone thought they could create such a subject, because I'm not convinced that in 3 years you can become an astronomer, a microbiologist, a chemist, a spacecraft engineer with any degree of credibility that's meaningful in that time. So I think astrobiology is a wonderful word for bringing people together in an interdisciplinary way. If you want to become an astrobiologist, get involved in societies. There's the European Astrobiology Network Association. If you want to go to a conference, there's Astrobiology Science Conference, which is next year, happens every 2 years. These are excellent activities to get involved with, to meet other astrobiologists. But in terms of training, decide what your favorite science is and do that independent of astrobiology, and then use that as a mechanism to address scientific questions in astrobiology. That would be my advice.
Okay, fantastic. I think that's great advice. Yeah, it does sound like it's a very interdisciplinary field. It sounds like there's a lot of stuff going into it.
In some sense, it's its strength, because it brings people together in different fields. And that's always a good thing. Some of the most interesting science questions are questions that interfaces between fields. But it's also its weakness, in the sense it can be very diffuse. One definition of astrobiology is the study of the origin, evolution and distribution of life in the universe. So in other words, life, the universe and everything, which is not necessarily a very helpful definition. You've got to be careful with it. It's useful in some ways, but it can also lead you down very diffuse paths where scientific questions are not well defined. So I think you need to use astrobiology in a productive way to address particular questions, but not get too dispersed, you know, with a sort of general interest in life and everything.
Amazing. Okay. Well, I thank you very much. I think that brings us to the end of our questions. But, you know, thank you so much for taking the time out today.
Thank you very much. It's been great fun to talk about. It's always fun to talk about these sorts of questions. Life in the universe is always interesting. So I'm grateful for you inviting me.
Great. Well, that about wraps the interview up. We just want to say a big thank you again to Professor Charles Coquel for such an interesting discussion. And of course, thanks to you for listening. This has been the first episode of Enlightened, the Science Podcast. Did you enjoy it? I hope you did. We'll be coming back with the next episode, which is on a very hot topic right now, vaccines, in approximately a month's time. So do look out for that. Enlightened Science podcast is created by Andrew Earle, Patricia Kloihofer, Shan Zhang, and Ollie Higgins for SISMA. We'd like to thank the CDTISM, the University of Edinburgh, and the University of Glasgow for funding and support. The intro music for this episode was by Joseph McDade, and it's called Space is Invisible Mind Dust and Stars Are But Wishes. Thanks very much for tuning in.